Parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It's 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 60th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you don't mind, let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. So most of you probably recognize that as sort of an iconic riff from one of the classic songs by Heart called Barracuda, as I often refer to it, Bacaruda. Yeah, and the reason I chose it is not because we're doing a fish story this evening or anything to do with the oceans or global warming, but because of the vocalist, Ann Wilson, of Heart, who has had a long-standing battle with the body dysmorphic scenario. So back in the 80s, when she was putting on a lot of weight, she still saw herself as this slender gal in her teen years, and had this distorted body image of herself as being slender when she was actually putting on a pretty good bit of weight. And she had what I call reverse dysmorphic disorder, because most people who have body dysmorphic disorder, as I do, think that they're fat or think that their nose is big or their ears are too lobe or whatever, when they're really not any of those things. And she sort of has the reverse of that, where she thought she was skinny when she was actually putting on a pretty good bit of weight. So I thought that'd be kind of an interesting intro to our topic this evening.
Wow, I actually never knew that about her, so that's very interesting.
That's why she got the anxiety, the stage fright, because she was reading the reviews on her performances, and the critics were going, oh, my God, she needs to lose weight, blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, that's probably true from a health standpoint, but I don't really give a flip what she looks like. If she sings like she sings, which is amazing to this day, I don't really care if she walks out in a wheelchair with a, you know, beanbag on her head. Yeah, I'm not paying people for their looks or their stage antics. I want to hear how well they sound vocally or instrumentally or whatever, but she took a pounding in the press for that, and even amongst the record companies, which is why they started featuring her sister in all the videos dressed up in the sexy outfits, and, you know, and that's why they started only doing clips of her and using funky lenses to make her look skinnier, and she was catching all kind of crap from the band members at the time. I mean, she really went through some stuff with that, which is why they kind of went off the rails for a while, and you didn't hear from them until they reemerged several years later with different band members. And I don't really blame her, because I wouldn't want to put up with that crap either. But yeah, that's why she had the anxiety stuff and was having stage fright and freezing on stage. And her sister was over there cueing her on the lyrics and stuff. I mean, it was pretty bad at one point.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Well, you know, good thing she came through it and stuff. She's been performing again.
Yeah, that gal has had a fabulous voice since day one and continues to have a fabulous voice, you know, and however old she is. And I really don't care what she looks like as long as she sounds good. I don't give a flip, and I'd rather have that than somebody who looks marvelous and who's lost their voice and can't sing worth a damn or can't play worth a heck, and they're up there, you know, trying to live off their previous glory. I'm like, no, get off the stage and retire before you sound like dog crap. And fortunately for her, that is not the case. She sounds killer. Love that guy.
Well, you know you're doing well when you show up for a tribute to Led Zeppelin, getting some honors over in the UK, and you do Stairway to Heaven, and the guys from Led Zeppelin applaud you.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. No doubt.
Yeah. So, excellent. As Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Body Dysmorphia and Gender Dysphoria, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Sure. So notwithstanding the previous trivia story, which I really hadn't intended to be a trivia story, but you're going to get a two-for-oneer this evening, and usually you pay people double for that. So tonight, that's right. Don't order yet. So tonight I thought I would pay homage to someone that most people have never heard of, but they know this person's product. And the gentleman's name who passed earlier this year in January was Alan Robert Perlman. And in case you don't know who that is, if you take the first three letters of his name, ARP, the synthesizer company. So, Mr. Perlman, ARP synthesizers, Alan Robert Perlman. Yeah, well, most people don't know that. I mean, you have to be a boring nerd like me to know that, because you have nothing better to do with your time. So, for those who don't know, Alan Perlman was a kid from New York, obviously a Jewish person, who studied originally at Worcester Polytech Institute in Massachusetts, and eventually ended up working for NASA, and eventually decided he wanted to do synthesizers. And, you know, this is a guy who had recognized early on that this was going to be the wave of the future, this electronic thing. And just after, you know, the mini Moog with Robert Moog, who's the other, you know, brainchild of the synthesizers who came out earlier, ARP, he formed the company ARP Synthesizers and introduced the first modular synth, which was the ARP 2500 in 1970. And the big difference between the ARP and the Moogs was that most of the Moogs have all these patchworks. So they were like, kind of like a ringy dingy and kind of like a patch board on the old school phone end boards, and so you had to have cords and patch the way that the signal chain was done using actual patch cords, and the ARPs did not do that. So they did away with all the patch cord foolishness stuff, which can get really technical and heady. I mean, you can get really, really cool sounds with them, but they're a learning curve, particularly if you're an idiot like me. They're a learning curve. So he came out without as many patch cords and had oscillators that were supposed to be more stable and reliable and in tune than the Moogs. So the 2500 was this huge thing with like three or four, you know, control boards behind the actual keyboard itself, the controller. And this eventually morphed into the 2600, which became a very, very, very popular synthesizer and led the way to the development of the Odyssey, which really just kind of blew the world up. And so during the 70s and early 80s, everybody from David Bowie to Joy Division to Elton John to Stevie Wonder to Herbie Hancock to who's the keyboard for Tony Banks for Genesis, all these folks were ARP users. So they really, really helped put him on the map. Unfortunately, in 1981, he declared bankruptcy, and I'm not quite sure what happened with that, and closed the company, and it got sold off to various folks. And then in 2015, the Korg company purchased the rights to ARP and started reintroducing their line, classic lineup. So they reintroduced the Odyssey and several of their other packages, their other synths, with the assistance of David Friends, who was the original co-owner of the company. He was Robert Perlman, Alan Robert Perlman, were the two founders of ARP. So he was one of the co-founders of that, and so he has kind of teamed up with Korg to reintroduce the ARP synthesizers to the world. So they're being manufactured again. And in addition to that, the virtual instruments, all the ARP virtual instruments have been issued as discs so that folks that want to use them in their digital audio workstations or DAWs, whether it's Pro Tools or Logic Pro or whatever, can dial them into those and play them. If they have a separate keyboard, can play them just like the real deal thing. And they've done a really, really good job of reproducing this, because I own one of the discs that has that stuff on it, and they're done very, 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 very well. And the other advantage is, if you're kind of a doofus when it comes to electronics and keyboards, which would be moi, a lot of these things have settings on them. So they have several of the Tony Banks settings that he used during the kind of heyday of Genesis, when it was a big prog rock, when Peter Gabriel was still with them. And you'll hear a lot of the ARP on the Selling England by the Pound recording, which is, I think, a 1973 recording. You also, the other biggie that you hear it on, besides Herbie Hancock's Headhunters, was using an Odyssey, was with Edgar Winter doing Frankenstein. That's an ARP synthesizer he's using on that. So those who know that from the album They Only Come Out at Night, which I think was also in 1973, that's an ARP 2600, and it's just unbelievable stuff that he does with that. The guys in Kraftwerk used ARP Odysseys also in the 74 albums that they did. And just, you know, did a bunch of stuff with it. And then the String Ensemble was released, which was very, 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 very popular. And the String Ensemble was sort of meant to be a smaller version of the Mellotron and a cheaper version of the Mellotron. And you hear a lot of the ARP stuff because Gary Wright was an ARP user. And his album in 75 that came out with Dreamweaver, that's got the ARP string section on it. So it's, you hear that everywhere. The synth pop band Ultravox also used it. Their main keyboard guy, Billy Curry, used it in ARP Odyssey. So you've heard this thing everywhere. And probably non-musicians' biggest introduction to the ARP, which is done with the original ARP 2500, which is this huge-ass beast, was done on the famous Steven Spielberg movie of 1977, Close Encounters of the Nerd Kind, as I like to refer to it. And that's no denigration of the movie, because it's a very cool movie. But that do-do-do-do-do is an ARP 2500. So a lot of the ARPs have definitely made their way around the world in a variety of genres. So it's not just the rock world or the prog rock world, or it's gone into the classical world and the world of funk and all kinds of, you know, new age and new wave stuff and all kinds of stuff. So The ARP and the Moog were probably the two biggest producers of synths of that era. And while the Moog carried on and is still carrying on even after Robert Moog's death, the ARPs have kind of gotten a second life with Korg re-upping them. So I wanted to give a shout out to that because Mr. Frohman died in January of this year, and I thought this was kind of a cool trivia and homage to him. I think he was 93 when he passed. So there you have it. Yeah.
And now you know the rest of the story. Thank you, Paul Harvey. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that. Again, a reminder to our listeners that we will take calls and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight Eastern Time. And please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, meat and potatoes time. Tonight's show is called Body Dysmorphia and Gender Dysphoria. The entire reason why we are covering these topics tonight and covering them together is due to the astounding prevalence of misunderstandings, not only of both conditions, but of a tendency to conflate them as interchangeable conditions, which they are not. And I'm going to tell one on myself. I had started to come up with this topic based on a false premise question because I was one of those people that mixed them up. And so this show became about don't do that. Several changes on the preferred nomenclature and labeling of certain related conditions and habits have only just occurred in the last 5 years or less. I had to throw out a lot of research on the web because it was from earlier than 2015 and it was talking complete shit and I couldn't use it. So this is an area of psychology, mental health, and related physiological conditions which is still being heavily studied and only recently well understood. We will do our best to navigate the most recent of vetted material. Oops, sorry, I'm turning a page, pardon me. So that our listeners are clear on the latest scientific facts and distinctions within this topic. So tonight we're going to discuss first, what exactly is body dysmorphia? We will have definitions, different types, and treatments where applicable. Next is gender dysphoria, which has to do with being transgender. And we're going to talk about that versus body dysmorphia, and then we'll talk about conclusions that we come to. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to bring up before we dive in.
I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So what exactly is body dysmorphia? This is a long question, or the answers are long, rather. So this first bit here, my sources are a combination of SarahVive.com, stuff I got from NIH, and stuff I got from the DSM-5. So, body dysmorphic disorder, or BDD. The DSM-5 category for this puts it under obsessive compulsive and related disorders. BDD, body dysmorphic disorder, is a diagnosis involving distress due to a perceived physical anomaly such as a scar, the shape or size of a body part, or some other personal feature. While most individuals feel a degree of doubt or dissatisfaction with their appearance at times, NHS 2012 talks about this, individuals with BDD will experience persistent and intrusive thoughts about the imagined flaw. ADAA 2014 documents that. Risk factors, possible causes. The DSM-5 indicates that child maltreatment is a risk factor for BDD. There is also an increased risk of BDD in first-degree relatives with OCD. That's from the APA in 2013. Sexual trauma can be a risk factor, according to Bowman, Marcus, and Wilhelm from 2012. Trauma can result in self-disgust for sexual parts or a part favored by the attacker, for example, hair. Peer abuse or bullying and teasing may be a contributing factor in BDD. That's from NHS 2014. Serotonin insufficiency or imbalance is one culprit that has been identified. And just to be clear, some of these things that we're listing by themselves in a vacuum are no big drama. They're very common. You need to look at context. You need to look at the prevalence and how much it screws with your everyday life in order to know whether you should be worried about this or talk to a doctor. So just because I name one thing that pertains to our listeners, don't freak out. But if you do hear several things that seem to apply, you may want to discuss it with a mental health professional, see what's going on. Comorbidity. The DSM-5 identifies depressive disorder, OCD, and substance use as disorders that are comorbid with BDD, and that's from the APA in 2013. Treatment for BDD. BDD is chronic, but responds favorably to treatment, according to Greenberg and Wilhelm 2014. CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, not computer-based therapy or other things that we won't discuss, as this show is just R, is an effective and evidence-based method of treating BDD by challenging irrational beliefs and perceptions regarding body features. That's according to the APA 2013, and also according to Kenny, Knott, and Cox in 2012. However, initiating treatment may be difficult, as people with BDD may not believe their excessive fixation on what they are convinced is a flawed body part is a psychological disorder. It is noted that SSRIs combined with CBT produce very favorable treatment outcomes. Kenny, Knott, and Cox 2012, also NHS 2014, support that statement. Differential diagnosis, in other words, things that need to be ruled out. Diagnostic rule-outs outlined in the DSM-5 include eating disorders, and we're going to talk about this again because I question that a little bit, OCD, somatic anxiety, major depressive disorder, anxiety disorders, and psychotic disorders. There are also several non-DSM-5 disorders and syndromes which are either rare or culturally specific, such as gender dysmorphia, olfactory reference syndrome, body identity integrity disorder, KORU, and dysmorphic concern, APA 2013. Note here, and these are my notes, this is from 2013, and as such is contrary to the point we're making tonight. The dysphoria does not even belong in this discussion, though it was until recently often included, and that's one of the points we're going to poke at tonight. Next, what are the common signs and symptoms of BDD? And the source for this is Wikipedia, but they have documentation to medical sources for this. Again, as I said earlier, the list itself in isolation can be fairly benign, so you have to look at how disruptive this is and how many of these are applicable. Avoiding social situations, public places, work, school, etc. And obviously this is in the context of, I don't want you to see that my nose is 2 feet long, or I don't want you to see the giant zit on my back that's really tiny and no one sees. Compulsive skin picking, which includes fingernails and tweezers to remove blemishes and or even hair. Covering up the, quote, affected area, for example, using hats, scarves, makeup, especially at times and places where most people would not be. Emotional problems such as feelings of disgust, depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, etc. And again, centered around a perception of your body. Frequent appointments with medical professionals and especially cosmetic surgeons and repeated plastic surgery. And of course, this is going to mean cosmetic surgery, not fixing a scarf as I had a birthmark or something. Frequent thoughts about appearance, at least an hour a day. Keeping your obsessions and compulsions secret due to feelings of shame, which is sort of your tell that something's wrong. Leaving the house less often, or only going out at night to prevent others from seeing the flaw. Repeatedly asking others to tell you that you look okay, also referred to as reassurance seeking. Spending a lot of time staring in a mirror and or reflective surface fixated on the flaw, or in some cases a complete avoidance of mirrors or reflective surfaces because you don't want to see the horrible thing. Now, how do you tell the difference between being unhappy with a part of your appearance and actually clinically having BDD. Many people are unhappy with some part of the way they look. However, if the amount of time and energy spent thinking about the body part interferes with day-to-day functioning or causes significant emotional distress, then the person is usually diagnosed with BDD. What parts of the body are often the focus of BDD? Most often, the head or face. Example, the hairline, nose, acne, the neck, etc. However, any body part can be the focus. Other common areas of concern can include arms, legs, stomach, hips, and hair. Now I'm going to read you some excerpts from a paper by an expert on the topic so our listeners can understand some of the complexities in diagnosing and treating these and related conditions. And the post was Diagnosis and Clinical Assessment in BDD, Body Dysmorphic Disorder, by Catherine Phillips, MD. Catherine Phillips, MD, is director of the Body Dysmorphic Disorder Program at Rhode Island Hospital and professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Perhaps the most important thing to keep in mind is that many patients with BDD do not spontaneously reveal their BDD symptoms to their clinician because they are too embarrassed and ashamed. They fear being negatively judged, for example, being considered vain, feel the clinician will not understand their appearance concerns, or do not know that body image concerns are treatable. Yet, research has shown that patients want their clinician to ask them about BDD symptoms. It is especially important to inquire about BDD symptoms in mental health settings, substance abuse settings, and settings where cosmetic treatment is provided, for example, surgical, dermatological, and dental. Diagnosing BDD. To diagnose BDD, the DSM-5 criteria should be followed. DSM-5 classifies BDD in the chapter of obsessive-compulsive and related disorders. The DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for BDD require the following. Appearance preoccupations. The individual must be preoccupied with one or more non-existent or slight defects or flaws in their physical appearance. Repetitive behaviors. At some point, the individual must perform repetitive, compulsive behaviors in response to the appearance concerns. These compulsions can be behavioral and thus observed by others, for example, mirror checking, excessive grooming, skin picking, reassurance seeking, or clothes changing. Clinical significance. The preoccupation must cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. Differentiation from an eating disorder. If the appearance preoccupations focus on being too fat or weighing too much, the clinician must determine that these concerns are not better explained by an eating disorder. Specifiers. Once BDD is diagnosed, clinicians should assess the two BDD specifiers to identify meaningful subgroups of individuals with BDD. And these two identifiers are muscle dysmorphia. Muscle dysmorphia form of BDD is diagnosed if the individual preoccupied with concerns that his or her body build is too small or insufficiently muscular. Many individuals with BDD are additionally preoccupied with other body areas. The muscle dysmorphia specifier should still be used in such cases. The other one is insight specifier. This specifier indicates degree of insight regarding BDD beliefs. For example, I look ugly or I look deformed. That is how convinced the individual is that his or her belief about the appearance of the disliked body parts is true. Levels of insight go with good or fair insight, with poor insight, and with absent insight or delusional beliefs. Note that absent insight delusional beliefs are diagnosed as BDD, not as a psychotic disorder. I'm actually going to pause here, Dr. Mathis, and check in with you real quick because this is fairly long still, and I wanted to give you a chance in case you had anything that you've been waiting to say.
I think I'm okay right now.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
No, so thank you for doing that. You might want to check in with me at the end of the next section, just, you know, with the reality break stuff and all.
Oh, yes, I have no doubt. Differential okay. diagnosis. BDD is often misdiagnosed as another disorder. It is important that BDD not be misdiagnosed as one of the following disorders, and I have a list for you guys. If it is misdiagnosed, patients may not receive appropriate care, or they may not improve with the treatment provided. So the ones that it could be misdiagnosed as, and we have to be careful not to, agoraphobia, avoidance of situations because of fears that others will see a person's perceived appearance defects, should count towards diagnosis of BDD rather than agoraphobia. Dysmorphic concern. This is not a DSM diagnosis, but it is sometimes confused with BDD. It includes concerns about body odor and somatic concerns, which are not BDD symptoms. Eating disorder. If a normal weight person is concerned about being fat or weight and does not meet diagnostic criteria for an eating disorder, then BDD should be diagnosed. Excoriation, skin picking disorder. When skin picking is intended to improve perceived effects in the appearance of one's skin, BDD should be diagnosed rather than excoriation, skin picking disorder. Generalized anxiety disorder. Unlike generalized anxiety disorder, anxiety and worry in BDD focus on perceived appearance flaws and, of course, are not generalized. Major depressive disorder. Unlike major depressive disorder, BDD is characterized by prominent preoccupation and excessive compulsive repetitive behaviors. BDD should be diagnosed in individuals with depression if diagnostic criteria for BDD are met. Obsessive compulsive disorder. If preoccupations and repetitive behaviors focus on appearance, including symmetry concerns, BDD should be diagnosed rather than OCD. Olfactory reference syndrome. Preoccupation with emitting a foul or unpleasant body odor is a symptom of olfactory reference syndrome, not BDD. Schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder. BDD-related psychotic symptoms, i.e. delusional beliefs about appearance defects or BDD-related delusions of reference, reflect the presence of BDD rather than a psychotic disorder. Social anxiety disorder, or social phobia. If social anxiety and social avoidance are due to embarrassment and shame about perceived appearance flaws and diagnostic criteria for BDD are met, BDD should be diagnosed rather than social anxiety disorder or social phobia. And trichotillomania, the hair pulling disorder. When hair tweezing, plucking, pulling, or other types of hair removal is intended to improve perceived defects in the appearance of body or facial hair, BDD should be diagnosed rather than trichotillomania. All right, I'm going to check in real quick and see, before we go to the next list, if you have anything you want to add, Dr. Mathis.
I just wanted to mention partialism, which is a subset of the body dysmorphic disorder, which in which somebody is focusing on a minute area of their body, just a partial part, ergo the term partialism, like mm-hmm. their belly button instead of their stomach being too fat, for example.
Okay, so it's a very specific area.
Yeah, it's like, you know, taking a small portion of BDD and, you know, oh, it's the left side of my nostril, oh, it's the arch, and, you know, it's small little things as opposed to, oh, my stomach's too big.
Got it. Okay, good to know. All right. The next part is variations of forms of body dysmorphia, as well as similar and related conditions, reality breaks, or body image self-delusions. And I've lumped all these together, but I'm also going to explain to you guys that in the DSM or in the professional arena, they're not necessarily lumped together. And I threw in a little lyric for you guys. This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful life by David Byrne of the Talking Heads in the song Once in a Lifetime. And I thought that kind of related to tonight. And I couldn't convince Dr. Mathis to sing it. Okay, the first part is body integrity dysphoria, BID, which has also been referred to as body integrity identity disorder, BIID, amputee identity disorder, or xenomelia, which was formerly called apotemnophilia. Good Lord, that's a mouthful.
That's what she said.
Yes. The term body integrity identity disorder, BIID, describes the extremely rare phenomenon of persons who desire the amputation of one or more healthy limbs or who desire a paralysis. As of 2014, it remained unclear whether BID is a form of human diversity or a mental disorder. That actually shocked me, but it was documented. Similar to the development of a concept of gender dysphoria. Now, yeah, and this is why I told you guys I threw out a lot of the older notes because they contained conclusions that we realize now are not valid. So I didn't want to use that stuff. There was debate about including it in the DSM-5, and it ended up not included. It was also not included in the ICD-10, but it was since included in the ICD-11 over in Europe, which reached a stable version in June 2018 as body integrity dysphoria. The ethics of surgically amputating the undesired limb of a person with BID are difficult and controversial. And I want to check in with you after this one. This is one of my sticking points on this one. This is a big shocker.
Well, actually, the one you just mentioned is kind of interesting for folks who want to get certain genitalia amputated in certain scenarios, because that would fall under this.
Now, I'm assuming you don't mean amputated because they're having gender dysphoria, correct?
No. They're amputating it because they want to morph into something, or as a symbol of submission in a DS-type relationship.
Okay.
Aha.
Uh-huh.
And okay. But unfortunately,
extreme
what's happening
body.
So what's happening with some of these folks is they're getting labeled as having a quote-unquote disorder because folks don't understand the context under which it's being done.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very. All right, so there's that one. The next one is body-focused repetitive behavior, and I have several of these. This is kind of a big blanket term, BFRB. This is a term that describes a set of compulsive behaviors that unintentionally cause physical damage to one's body and affect appearance. The key difference between BFRBs and other compulsive behaviors that cause harm to the body, like cutting or burning yourself, is that BFRBs are characterized by direct body-to-body contact. BFRBs are among the most poorly understood, underdiagnosed, and untreated groups of disorders. Research suggests that at least one out of every 20 people has a BFRB, with trichotillomania, which is compulsive hair pulling disorder, alone believed to affect about 10 million people in the United States alone. Other BFRBs include excoriation disorder, or skin picking that we just discussed earlier, acinophagia, which is nail biting, dermatophagia, which is compulsive skin biting, rhinotelexomania, which is compulsive nose picking, and suddenly I'm 12, and trichophagia, which is the compulsive urge to eat one's own hair. And this is also not pica, which is a different disorder.
Yeah, pica is eating any non-nutritive substance like paper or dirt.
Right. Although hair kind of seems like it would qualify, but since it's off your body, I guess it doesn't really count.
Well, and what's the main component of hair is protein.
Ah, okay. So, that's
so
fair.
For those of you who don't want to do your protein shake, grind up your hair and put it in your drink.
Ew! Oh, I'm sorry. We have a
talk
really
about
bad
a hair raising experience.
Just hang up and call back. Ow! Okay, bye. Bye. Oh my god,
he's at it again.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
No, I can't. Okay. All right, so BFRB, there's a couple of subsections here that I want to address on their own. Dermatophagia differs from excoriation disorder, you know, the skin picking thing, in that the repetitive motion affected persons partake of is in the biting of the skin. People who have dermatophagia can also be prone to infection because when they bite their fingers so frequently, they make themselves vulnerable to bacteria seeping in and causing infection. They get these big festering wounds on their hands from chewing on their fingers. It's not like nail biting where you happen to catch the bottom of the finger. You're biting the whole finger and down into the hand and causing infections.
That's why if you're a vampire, you should brush your teeth before you bite somebody in the neck.
Yes. Yes. I'm sure there are many vampires who are listening because it's well after dark on the East Coast.
I'm telling you.
Okay. So BFRB subset excoriation, skin picking disorder, commonly referred to as dermatillomania, is a compulsive habit associated with anxiety. It's similar to OCD and not OCPD, in which the sufferer repeatedly picks at their skin, potentially causing damage like bleeding, sores, or scarring. It can be difficult to diagnose a clear line between mere dislike of one's flaws and a compulsion and a complete inability to leave them alone. Next section, other reality breaks and body image delusions. Delusional misidentification syndrome is an umbrella term introduced by Christo Dulu in his book, The Delusional Misidentification Syndromes, with Karger and Basil in 1986. For a group of delusional disorders that occur in the context of mental and neurological illness, they all involve some kind of belief that the identity of a person, object, or place has somehow changed or been altered. As these delusions typically only concern one particular topic, they also fall under the category called monothematic delusions. And here I have some notes. This is not listed in the DSM as a form of dysmorphia, but rather we are including these as other forms of delusion or misidentification to do with oneself or people and objects with which one interacts. As with dysphoria, these are conditions that might seem the same or be confused for dysmorphia by lay people. So we're offering a quick primer to let our listeners tell various pathologies apart correctly. So that's why we're including these, even though they're not in the same place in the DSM and some are not in there at all. So this psychopathological syndrome is usually considered to include four main variants. Capgras delusion, that's C-A-P-G-R-A-S, is a psychiatric disorder in which a person holds a delusion that a friend, spouse, parent, or other close family member or even pet has been replaced by an identical imposter. The Capgras delusion is classified as a delusional misidentification syndrome, a class of delusional beliefs that involve the misidentification of people, places, and objects. Fregoli's delusion is the belief that various people the believer meets are actually the same person in disguise. Like Capgras delusion, psychiatrists believe it is related to a breakdown in normal face perception. So in other words, the body is giving you bad data in the first place. So you're coming to these conclusions because you're not reading stuff correctly, like on a biological level. Inner metamorphosis is the belief that people in the environment swap identities with each other while maintaining the same appearance. Subjective doubles, described by Christo Dulu in 1978 in the American Journal of Psychiatry, I think these are volume numbers in 1978, is the belief that there is a doppelganger or double of him or herself carrying out independent actions. However, similar delusional beliefs, often singularly or more rarely reported, are sometimes also considered to be part of the delusional misidentification syndrome. For example, clonal pluralization of the self, where a person believes there are multiple copies of him or herself, identical both physically and psychologically, but physically separate and distinct. Cotard delusion is a rare disorder in which people hold a delusional belief that they are dead, either figuratively or literally, they do not exist, are putrefying, have lost their blood or internal organs. In rare instances of this, it can include delusions of immortality. COTAR delusion is not included in either the DSM or ICD at this time. Neurologically, the COTAR delusion, negation of the self, is thought to be related to the Capgras delusion I just mentioned, people being replaced by imposters. Each type of delusion is thought to result from neural misfiring in the fusiform face area of the brain, which is what recognizes faces, and in the amygdalae, which associate emotions with a recognized face. These areas may be damaged in some way or interfered with, and so that causes the inability to recognize stuff. Delusional companion syndrome is a belief that objects, such as, for example, soft toys, are sentient beings. And we know small children that do this all the time, but we're talking about adults. Mirrored self misidentification is the belief that one's reflection in a mirror is some other person. Reduplicative paramnesia is a belief that a familiar person, place, object, or body part has been duplicated, existing in two or more places simultaneously, or that it has been relocated to another site. And then last, I have a separate note, not from this study, about anorexia nervosa and bulimia. So there is still a great deal of debate as to whether or not anorexia nervosa and or bulimia constitute a form of BDD. BDD's relationship to eating disorders, anorexia in particular, has scarcely been discussed, despite these disorders' shared core feature of disturbed body image. Although dieting can be a feature of BDD that involves a body part perceived to be large, eating and weight are not usually disturbed in BDD, and BDD is not diagnosed if an eating disorder is thought to be present. And at this point, I'm going to pause and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and I'm especially interested in what you have to say on the last part.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I was going to say that people with BDD, including myself, don't necessarily restrict eating. They don't vomit. They don't do crazy exercises, all of which people with anorexia nervosa and or bulimia nervosa do. They don't binge eat. They don't purge. They don't do any of that kind of stuff. They just fret, moan, wail, and, you know, get all upset about the part of their body that they are parts that they consider to be inferior, bad, too big, too small, whatever. So while eating disorders share the distorted body image, some people with BDD, including myself, recognize the BDD as irrational. So your cognitive brain goes, yep, you're crazy. And your emotional brain goes, but wait a minute. Right, so it's this battle that most anorexics and bulimics that I've worked with don't recognize that what they're doing is irrational. You can show an anorexic. Yeah, you can show an anorexic a mirror, and, I mean, you can see their organs pumping. They've lost so much weight, and they're looking in the mirror saying things like, oh, my God, I need to lose another 5 pounds. They're almost. Yeah. I mean, it's almost delusional. The BDD people are not.
Okay, so even though they're not seeing their body as it really is, that would not qualify them for BDD because of the other stuff. Is that basically it?
No, if they recognize that they can have BDD and recognize that their body dysmorphia is irrational, right? But they're not doing anything specifically about it. The anorexics and the bulimics do not know that their belief system is screwed. They don't get it.
Okay.
They don't believe.
Got it. Okay. Perfect. Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to expound on in the last section before we go forward?
No, I'm good. That was it.
Okay. Fabulous. All right. So here is the pièce de résistance, one of the main reasons I wanted to do this show. Gender dysphoria, which has to do with being transgender, or versus body dysmorphia. And as I said, I told it on myself a whole crap ton of people because the words are similar and portions of the things you deal with are similar, as in, you know, dissonance about your body. We conflate these as the same thing, and people go, well, you know, why is this one something that you treat and why is that one okay? and so forth. And that's how this whole question came up. So we spent a good deal of time helping our listeners understand the breadth of behaviors covered under the umbrella of dysmorphia, as well as related dysfunctions of recognition, perceiving reality, and perceiving the self. Now, all this is important in order to be able to process this next discussion, which is comparing and contrasting dysmorphia and dysphoria. So what is dysphoria? Dysphoria is the exact opposite of euphoria, and most of y'all know what that is. It is a profound state of unease or dissatisfaction, dysphoria is. In a psychiatric context, dysphoria may accompany depression, anxiety, or agitation. Gender dysphoria is a condition where a person experiences discomfort or distress because there is a mismatch between their biological sex and gender identity. This mismatch between sex and gender identity can lead to distressing and uncomfortable feelings that are called gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria is a recognized medical condition for which treatment is sometimes appropriate. It is not a mental illness, which is why the word disorder has been removed from the DSM and the ICD. Now, going back, what is dysmorphia? We've talked about it already, but let me remind you. So we spoke extensively earlier about dysmorphia in a clinical context. We'd like to compare definitions and terms here because the similarities both in word structure and in common symptoms contribute to many lay people's confusion and even hostility about several of these conditions. It's important to recognize that this word means something slightly different out in the proverbial wild than it does in a clinical context. The word definitions dictionary suggest a legitimacy to the concerns that does not belong to the psychological disorder. So definitions of dysmorphia, the word. Deformity or abnormality in the shape or size of a specified part of the body, or a condition in which someone falsely believes that there is something seriously wrong with their appearance. Now, how do these two terms differ? In short, someone with dysmorphia has a severe disconnect with reality and is obsessively in denial of fact, whereas someone with dysphoria perceives reality just fine, but has trouble relating to it or identifying with it. Their internal sense of self says things aren't different, but they should be different. But their perception is perfectly fine. This is why gender dysphoria should never be equated with dysmorphia, even though at first glance they may appear to share some traits. So how are body dysmorphia and gender dysphoria treated? That's the interesting thing. One of the reasons gender dysphoria has been declassified as a disorder is because of the way treatment works. In the case of a mental disorder, psychotherapy and medication are generally shown to be helpful. And this is the case for body dysmorphia, the first part that we talked about. People who suffer from eating disorders benefit greatly by cognitive and behavioral therapy and by the use of anti-anxiety and depression medications, including SSRIs. People dealing with gender dysphoria, on the other hand, do not experience relief from the sense of dissonance when put on medication. And though therapy is often helpful, it does not cause the dysphoria to subside. And I have a couple quick notes that are important for you guys to know on gender dysphoria and being transgender. And this is a repeat of earlier, but it really needs to be emphasized because this is apparently not common knowledge. Gender dysphoria is a condition where a person experiences discomfort or distress because there's a mismatch between their biological sex and gender identity. Actually, I pasted something I said to you guys earlier, so I'm not going to reread that. But it is just important to remember, and most of all, that it's not a mental illness. It's a recognized medical condition. You will see a lot of people say otherwise in social media. Feel free to send them a copy of our show later. So one quick thing I want to mention, because this does come up a lot, why do we use the word transgender and not transgendered with ED on it? Although both terms have been used by the trans community in the past, the preferred terminology is now trans or transgender. This reflects the understanding that being transgender is an innate experience rather than an event or something that happens to an individual. Transgender is a state of being, not the result of a past action. In the same way that you wouldn't say someone was British, you wouldn't say someone is transgendered. Rather, you would say, you would refer to them as British and then as transgender. And the source for this is the website queergrace.com, an online encyclopedia for LGBTQ and Christian life. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything else you want to add here.
Yeah, so I want to talk about the dysmorphia being a disconnect with reality. It's not a disconnect with reality in the sense that people are delusional, they're not crazy. It's a disconnect with emotional reality and physical reality, so that somebody feels like they have a big nose or feels like their face is disproportionate or feels like they're fat. They know in fact that they may not be cognitively, but they feel it. They're not crazy. They don't have breaks with the reality. They're not delusional. And some people with dysmorphia recognize that they're being stupid and irrational and you know, silly, as I do. But some people don't. They go, yeah, I know it's really not. According to the statistics, my weight's okay or my nose is okay, but I just think it's too big. So they'll acknowledge that the reality is different from their perception, but they typically will believe their perception opposed to reality. But they're not, you know, they'll feel their perception, although they realize the reality contradicts their perception, and they're willing to accept the reality. They just still feel it, and therefore they want to act on the feeling. They're not crazy. So that's one thing I wanted to say. Second thing I wanted to say is that you can also, with body dysmorphia, in lieu of doing anxiolytics, anti-anxiety meds, or depression meds, you can also, there's some herbal things you can do with that for folks who prefer that avenue, although certainly you can go the medication route. And finally, the transgender and gender dysphoria / transgender persons, the reason, in my personal opinion, the reason that that's not a disorder is because those folks who are truly transgender, they know that stuff from day one. You know, every real, what I call real transgender person, and I'll tell you what I mean by that in a minute, knew that there was, you know, something wrong in the state of Denmark as early as, you know, 3 and 4 and 5. These are not folks who wake up at 9, 10, 15, 22 and go, oh, I should have been a man, or, oh, I should have been a woman. These folks have disconnect feelings between their gender assignment, their physiological gender, and their mental gender, what I'm going to talk about, what their brain says that they are and what their brain's configured to be. They know that very, very early. So sometimes you'll see people come in and they're just dissatisfied with life, and they go, since it's now been, as I like to call it, cheek you and deboner to be transgender, they'll go, oh, I'm dissatisfied with my life, so maybe I should change my gender. These are not true transgender folks. Folks who are truly transgender, they've known it all their lives. Whether they've chosen to speak up about it or do something about it's another issue, because there's a lot of backlash with those folks in some scenarios. But folks who are truly transgender, they're not crazy. They know that their body and their brain aren't matching up, and they've known it for a long, long, long time. And I think that we in the medical and psychological community are just now kind of, you know, getting a clue about that. So that's all I wanted to say.
Got it. Good. Yeah, the first part was helpful because in the notes that I saw online, nobody really mentioned that. They painted it as an actual disconnect from what's really going on rather than, I know it looks normal, but I have feelings, you know. I didn't see a lot of that mentioned. I don't know why that is. They don't seem to mention it a whole lot.
My guess is it's just they just didn't go to the trouble to really get into it. And, you know, as a guy with it and a mental health professional, I understand the syndrome incredibly well, as well as my own internal self-talk that's incredibly reality, not true. But I know it's not true, so I'm not trying to go, no, it really is true. No, it's not. I'm being a dumbass.
True.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I thought we did an earlier episode in which you told me crazy was a legal term, not a medical term. I'm just saying.
That is correct. Insanity is a medical term. Insanity is a medical term. Yes.
Okay. Fair enough.
There you go.
All righty.
Crazy is a Willie Nelson term.
Crazy.
Yeah, that's right. He's the author of that.
Oh, I did not know that. Well, more power to him. It's a good song.
Yeah,
okay,
he got famous because what's her name sang the song, Patsy Cline,
yeah,
and made it famous, and that's how he got it. That really was his big break in the music business. But he's the author of that song.
Oh, good to know. All right,
more
so
trivia,
conclusions.
Right?
Yes. Hey, you know, trivia is great. That's part of why we started doing this. So conclusions for you guys. In summary, body dysmorphia is a broad and somewhat complicated category of mental health issues, mostly to do with perception of reality in some way. There are some other conditions that might seem like they are related, but some of them are not, most of all, gender dysphoria. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything further you want to tag on to that.
Yep, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So it's getting close to midnight, and this concludes our show on body dysmorphia and gender dysphoria. So we hope our listeners now better understand these two conditions and the complicated relationships between them, as well as the significant differences. All right, is there anything else that you might like to add in closing before we wrap up here?
No, I'd just like to say that if any of our listeners, either tonight or at later dates, have any questions and they want to shoot them our way, feel free to do that. And you know, if I can be of assistance answering them, I'll be happy to try to respond to them, you know, as best I can.
Yes, absolutely. You know, feel free to message Facebook. We're on Twitter. The website has an email address that you guys can use. So, you know, whatever works for you guys. And I actually think Dr. Mathis's professional phone number is on the website as well. And I think it's on Facebook. So, you know, feel free to avail yourselves if you have questions about this or wondering if it's about you or, you know, anything that's on your mind regarding this, because a lot of people feel like they can't talk about it. So we're here to let you know that you absolutely can, and with people who understand and will respect that. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and also give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks on Wednesday, January 23rd, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. Our upcoming show topics for this show include, on the 23rd, we are doing shaming as a form of discipline for kids. Is it effective or even appropriate? On February 6th, we'll be doing labels, the stigma of diagnoses for kids and their parents, as well as for diagnosed adults. And the 20th of February, we will be doing Separating the Artist from Their Art. Why is it so important to us to decide whether or not we want to appreciate or patronize an artist when the human being is despicable, but the creations are meaningful to us? This is a really huge thing in social media right now, because a lot of celebrities have been caught doing really horrific things, and they do art that we really love, so now everybody's really torn up about it. So we're going to talk about that. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of days. On Thursday, January 10th, tomorrow night, Travel Itch Radio goes on at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. And for those of you who want to follow my other show on NDB Media, Sunday, February 10th, The Walking Dead Online Viewing Party returns for Season 9, Episode 9, New Enemy, which is a mid-season opener. So join us then at 8:30. P.M. Eastern Standard Time to catch up on what we've missed since Thanksgiving and discuss what is to come in the back half of Season 9 of The Walking Dead. So please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.